Volume 3, Chapter 23. Rhode Island Responds. The question now arose, would Boston remain isolated and hence fall victim to English might? Would Massachusetts be vulnerable as the only colony to take the issue to the streets and rebel against British power? Or would the bulk of the American colonies follow and press on to victory? The question was soon answered. As soon as the inspiring news of August 14 was heard, Rhode Island, always libertarian, always indomitable, leaped to follow Boston's example. Rhode Island, enjoying a flourishing and extensive trade, had been spared the burdens of an executive oligarchy chosen by Britain. Its governors were popularly elected and were fully as hostile to British tyranny as the populace. Aside from a few royal appointees, such as the customs collector and naval officers, the wrath of Rhode Islanders was directed against the ultra-Tory Newport Junto, which had petitioned for an end to Rhode Island's charter as a home rule colony. Agitation began in earnest on August 24, when William Goddard published an special, extraordinary issue of the Providence Gazette. It was an all-resistance issue. On the masthead were inscribed two mottos, Vox Populi, Vox Dei, and Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. Articles filled the issue attacking the British regulations, stamp masters, and Jared Ingersoll, the Connecticut stamp master, and praising the Boston rebels. The issue also reprinted the hard-hitting resolves of the Providence town meeting, which denied Parliament's right to tax the colonies, and urged a indemnification of all Rhode Island officials refusing to obey the Stamp Act. Moreover, the mob actions in Boston, as well as in New London and Norwich, Connecticut, were described in loving detail. 2 days later, the Newport Mercury acquainted its readers with the mob actions in Boston and Connecticut. On August 27, the people of Rhode Island followed in the footsteps of Boston. Massachusetts was no longer isolated. Leading the action were three prominent merchants of Newport, the educated William Ellery, Robert Crook, and Samuel Vernon. On the morning of the 27th, a mob of Newporters marched through the streets, carrying three effigies with halters around their necks, and finally hanging them upon the gallows in front of the town courthouse. Guarding the scaffold were the three leading merchants of Newport, carrying clubs. The three marked men hanging in effigy were carefully selected, all members of the Newport Junto. Augustus Johnston, appointed stamp distributor for Rhode Island, Martin Howard Jr., and Dr. Thomas Moffat. Their effigies were appropriately and suggestively strung together. Hung with the effigies was a copy of a song beginning with the warning verse, "He who for a post or base sordid pelf his country betrays, makes a rope for himself. Of this an example for you we bring in these infamous rogues who in effigy swing." The three marked men quickly took the hint. Moffat fled town, and Howard and Johnston fled to the safety of the British ship Signet in the harbor, where they were joined by the hated customs collector John Robinson. For Robinson knew, as he put it, the disposition of the people towards all king's officers. The crowd then cut down the effigies and burned them in a bonfire. Nothing more was done that night, and the Tories returned to a supposed calm. But the next day, news of the second great Boston riot reached the Newporters, who determined not to lag in the libertarian cause. That evening, a group of men headed by Samuel Crandall buffeted Robinson a bit on the street. When the group was then arrogantly chastised by Martin Howard, he thereby provided the needed spark for provoking the Newporters into direct action. A mob quickly gathered, and gave Howard's house the treatment that their Boston confrères had meted out to Hutchinson's. The mob had tasted action. They proceeded to the houses of their other mortal enemies. Dr. Moffat's house was razed. Each house, in turn, of the British and Tory leaders was visited, and each of the men was eagerly sought by the mob. But all of them had escaped to the Signet. Augustus Johnston wanted to stand fast, but thought better of it, and fled when informed that the crowd would present him with the choice of resigning his post or being lynched on the spot. Johnston's house was visited, and only spared when his friends assured the mob that the absent stamp distributor would resign his office the next day. The revolutionary upsurge of August 28 proved brilliantly effective. His friends and family threatened as well as himself. Johnston kept his pledge and resigned his post the next day. Howard and Moffat decided to leave the dust of Newport behind them and sail back to England without even returning to shore. Thus, by August 29, the people of Newport had succeeded in forcing the stamp distributor to resign and the two leaders of the Newport Junto to leave the colony. But some of the mob now threatened to get out of hand. John Weber, a young Englishman recently arrived in Rhode Island, had actually led the mob the night before, and he now wanted more action. Weber began to insult the very merchants who had induced him to lead the previous night's riot. Apprehensive of potential blind violence by Weber and some of the mob, the other leaders turned Weber over to the Signet as a kind of sacrificial offering. This betrayal of their former comrade to the British was a grave tactical as well as moral error by Ellery, Vernon, and others, who were soon to form the Newport Sons of Liberty. Weber's followers among the mob gathered quickly and threatened immediate destruction of the houses of the betrayers if Weber were not released. Faced with a prospect of a dose of their own medicine, Ellery, Vernon, and the others capitulated and told the naval officers that Weber was not guilty of leading the riots. The triumphant Weber, back ashore, resumed his bravado and continued to threaten destruction of the houses of the Sons of Liberty leaders. The Sons of Liberty leadership was now thoroughly frightened of a mob commanded by the aimless, hot-headed Weber. They offered bribes to Weber, but to no avail. A threat of armed self-defense by the leaders got the mob to disperse that night, but the next day Weber returned to the attack, threatening plunder and destruction. Finally, none other than Augustus Johnston saved the day by courageously seizing Weber and carting him off to jail. The mob surprisingly did not react, and for a while Newport was safe from the wanton destruction threatened by John Weber. The stamp distributor had resigned, but the hated and inflexibly dictatorial John Robinson still remained, although aboard the Signet. The morning after the riot, Samuel Crandall sent a message to Robinson, offering him something like the old pre-1764 arrangement of annual bribes to the customs officials for allowing the merchants freedom of trade. Crandall also demanded the return from Halifax of the sloop Polly and her cargo of molasses, seized the previous spring by Robinson and his aides. In return for Robinson's agreement, he would also be granted protection ashore from the wrath of the people. Robinson reacted in characteristic fashion by ordering the arrest of Crandall and offering $100 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of any other rioters. The people of Newport would not be intimidated. The sheriff returned the warrant for arrest, stating that such was impossible to execute, except at the risk of his life in the current popular climate, and no one appeared to serve as paid informer upon his colleagues. Robinson now appealed to Governor Samuel Ward to guarantee his protection ashore and to arrest Crandall. But Ward, in obvious sympathy with the rebels, had left town during the rioting and now kept suavely assuring Robinson that all was calm, that no one was in danger, and that Crandall was a peaceful citizen. However, the merchants of Newport found themselves presented with a grave problem that was soon, in different form, to plague all the colonies when the stamp tax came into force. For if Robinson remained on the ship with the custom house closed, no ship leaving port could have official clearance papers. And without clearance papers, any ship was subject to seizure on the high seas by the British fleet. The British Navy, dedicated to the Crown and unchecked on the seas by the American populace, loomed as the preeminent menace to mercantile trade. Within a week, therefore, Ward provided Robinson with a bodyguard, and the customs house opened once more. The port might be open, but as November 1 approached, John Weber remained in jail, a constant potential of trouble to the citizens of Newport. The sheriff, indeed, was repeatedly threatened with harm if Weber were not released. On November 1, the Sons of Liberty organized a peaceful demonstration against the Stamp Act, taking care to avoid any mob violence that might be channeled into a movement to free John Weber. A mock grand funeral of freedom was organized that day, with old freedom arising triumphantly from its coffin. When no rescue party came, Weber, now 2 months in jail, tried to commit suicide in his cell. This attempt touched off a rather feeble effort to rescue Weber, resulting in but 2 of his followers being arrested. The Weber threat was over, but from that time on, the Sons of Liberty made sure of tight control over any direct mass action in Newport. The town of Providence was inspired by the rebellious actions of Newport, and on August 29-30, a crowd hung and burned an effigy of Augustus Johnston. However, with the British officials and Tory Junto both in Newport, Providence was on the fringes of the struggle, and could, by such action, only demonstrate its solidarity with its sister city.